Hello, girls, boys, and everyone in between. I'm Scarlett.
I'm Roxy.
And I'm Marjorie.
And we are the Red Resistance Podcast.
Before we get started, a little light housekeeping. Please rate, review, and subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to us. It helps us get a little higher up on the podcast food chain, but also, we just really like to know how we're doing. Head pats make us very giddy. Also, please check out our Patreon. Patreon is essentially an online tip jar. You have the option of making a one-time donation or becoming a monthly sustaining donor of varying tiers. There, you will have access to cut content, ridiculous outtakes from those days where our deviations are too precious to delete, and early episode releases. We know times are tough. They are for us, too. But if you're lucky enough to have a little to spare, throw some at us on Patreon. It helps keep the lights on and the Hulu subscription running. Find us on patreon.com/theredresistance or search on Patreon for the Red Resistance Podcast. We appreciate it so very much. Finally, be aware that there will be spoilers from the book, future episodes of the show, and potential tie-ins to the book's sequel, The Testaments. They are not detailed and serve to further the analysis of the show. It will be okay, I promise. So with that, grab the beverage of your choice and let us commence dissecting our favorite dystopian TV show. Well, hey there, podcast buddies. How you doing today?
So good, Scarlett. How are you?
I'm so excited.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Are you pumped, a la Aunt Lydia?
I'm so pumped. So pumped. How are you guys feeling?
I'm feeling super pumped, too. I'm also, a bit flabbergasted because we're already at episode 5 of season 4, and there's only 10 episodes in season 4. So we're in our mid-season 4s right now. We're halfway there.
It's pretty wild.
It's bizarre. See, this is my one problem with them release. I mean, aside from having to deal with 3 episode drops in one day and the absolute bombardment, this is my one problem with it is it already feels like it's fleeting. It's getting away from us before we can really enjoy it. And it didn't really hit me that we're at the middle right now until we sat down about an hour ago, 4 hours ago at this point. But when we sat down, I was like, wait a second. I was like, we have 5 more episodes after this. This is bizarre. I love it.
Yeah.
I can give you an alternate viewpoint if you want to feel better about the fact that we're at 5.
Always.
Once we get all the way through the season, then we'll really have that full picture analysis that I prefer.
That's a good point.
Up until this point, a lot of it just turns into theories and hypothesizing, and once
conjecture.
We get to the end, we can talk for another entire off season on all the things that we think now that we've seen this season as a whole. So
that is a very
don't you
good
worry
point.
There's always room for content.
You mean that the 3 of us will not be at a loss for words?
It's not even possible.
I haven't seen it yet, but someday I imagine it will happen.
Let me kick off this episode by telling our listeners a story of anticipation and disappointment. Yesterday, when we were just kind of getting our shit together and waiting to record episode 4, I was a naughty girl. I went ahead and I started watching part of episode 5. I'm like, you know what? It's only going to be 20 minutes, whatever. You know what? I know I have to watch it later. I'll just get ahead of the game. So picture it, Connecticut, 2021, approximately 20 minutes into this episode, where Lydia and Larry are about to have their showdown. And at this point, I have to stop. I didn't want to, but I had to because we had to get to podcasting. And it was reminiscent of having your vibrator die while you're on the precipice of an orgasm. And I couldn't watch for 5 hours. What the fuck?
Oh, it was even worse than those 5 hours because we did a Patreon episode where theorized all sorts of potentials. And a lot of it revolved around this Larry and Lydia scene that we knew was coming and we were waiting to see. And meanwhile, you're sitting on the precipice of that scene and still couldn't contribute to that conversation in any way other than, yep, I know the scene happens, definitely happens. It's about to happen. And oh, when you, because you told me that it came at 20 minutes when you had to stop, but you didn't tell me what scene it was at the time. And so when I got to that 20 minute mark and I saw that we were in the Lydia Larry scene, and I'm like, oh, you have better self-control than me. I would have been like, sorry, guys, running late.
It was very difficult. I will say that.
It's the Handmaid's equivalent of edging.
What the fuck is edging?
I am so glad I knew something before you sexually. Oh, yay. Yay.
Marjorie, I love it. Edging is when you bring yourself very close to orgasm, but you don't allow yourself, your pleasure, and you bring yourself back down. And you bring yourself super close to an orgasm, and then you stop your pleasure. And the whole point is that it eventually, like when you do allow yourself to have an orgasm, exactly, you're building and building. It ends up being an intense, insane, like mind-boggling, toe-numbing experience.
Okay, I didn't know there was a name for that.
Yeah, edging. Now it's really funny because as I was like, yeah, I knew something before you, my heart was like, oh God, don't ask me to explain it because I'm probably wrong. But I was right. I was like, it probably means something totally different and I'm just an idiot.
So shall we talk about drinks?
Yeah. I just hit puberty. Yes, please.
I'll go first because I can be super quick. Let's put it this way. I didn't think I was going to have a drink tie-in today because I wasn't planning on it. I didn't even realize we were going to be recording this today. So I didn't think of picking up a beer yesterday when I was at the package store. However, the beer that I did absentmindedly pick up without thinking of a tie-in at all kind of works. It is by Off Color Brewing. It's a Leipzig style ghost ale brewed with hibiscus flowers. And it's from Chicago.
Woo!
Yeah, the beer is called Sparkles Finds Some Trouble. Sparkles the cat. And I don't know, I guess you could say that through pretty much this entire series, June is Sparkles. Sparkles the June is always finding trouble, but I still love her and I still love this beer because this is the shit. Seriously, find this. It's really, really fantastic. It's got a low ABV, which is very pleasant. It kind of tastes like apple cider, which is really interesting because it's not a cider at all, but it really reminds me of apple cider and I'm digging it.
June's finding good trouble.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Did you guys know that Elizabeth Moss's cat looks exactly like my cat?
You had texted us that. Yeah.
Oh, man. I was so excited when I saw that. Yeah, she was on Good Morning America the other day, and her cat started walking behind her on the couch because cats have to insert themselves into everything that you do. And her cat's name is Ethel, which I thought was adorable. And I'm positive Ethel makes an appearance in season one. If not an appearance, she talks about her. Because isn't it like when she's meeting Luke for the first time and they're talking about her cat Ethel and her cell phone pictures? Do you remember?
That totally could be a thing because it felt like a familiar thing when you said cat named Ethel, but I couldn't quite place it. Yeah, that could definitely be where that was. Oh, that's so funny. What? I love that.
Ethel is a legit cat, and she could totally be a sister from another mister to my cat because they're identical.
I love that you bring that up because with our new found YouTube platform, people are seeing our faces for the first time. And I forgot that you look so much like Elizabeth Moss. Like, I know this in my mind. We've talked about this.
Mm-hmm. And we have?
Yes, yeah. We have. And we talked about it when we first started this podcast. And we were like, wow, not only do you look like Elizabeth Moss, but you sound like her too. Actually, my kid was the first person to point it out to me. She's like, she saw The Handmaid's Tale on TV and was like, that's Scarlett. And I was like, oh, I see it. Like I hadn't, and then I couldn't stop seeing it. And then remember when we found that picture of Irma Grease and I was like, this looks like Scarlett and Elizabeth Moss. Mm-hmm. Like this is the two of them. This is this picture. Yikes. So somebody in the YouTube comments was like, I don't know if I'm just like late to the party here, but I can't stop looking at Scarlett when she reads the monologue of June. It sounds like her. It looks like her. Am I the only one seeing this? And I was like, no, I forgot that we actually have talked about it. And I just, because, you know, we've only had a podcast for so long, no one's really seen your face, more or less. Yeah. And yeah, I forgot that there is a resemblance to Elizabeth Moss in your face, Scarlett, and apparently in your cat's as well.
Oh, just wait until I go blonde.
I know. That's the only thing that's always wanted to do. Probably why I didn't notice it right away. But yeah. Mm-hmm.
I'm going to fuck all you guys up once I do that.
I love it. Marjorie, do you have a drink tie-in today or shall
I
go?
Yeah, I do. I have a drink tie-in. But if you're watching on YouTube and you can see in my cup, it's not actually what I'm drinking because I decided we're doing two recordings back to back Sunday into Monday. And I just decided on this break that I just couldn't do any more drinking at this point. So I am drinking some tea, but I do have a really great tie-in for later. And because we are drinking two back-to-back days and I only prepared for one day, I have to work with a limited amount of supplies and alcohol. But I came up with a really great drink. It is called You Are Not Alone, and it is a play on a sidecar, because twos. And also, I had the ingredients, so I was quite impressed with myself. But I used, instead of a cognac, I used amaretto, and I took some frozen raspberries, and I put the amaretto in, let it defrost, and mashed it up. I can show you that sitting over on my table over there. That's as far as my drink got in actuality. Then hit it with a little Grand Marnier and lemon juice and strain it. And you have You Are Not Alone, the Handmaid's version of a sidecar.
Oh, my word. That sounds delicious. I'm an absolute slut for sidecars. They are one of my favorites. Oh, I love sidecars so aggressively.
I don't think I've ever had one.
I have either. I was excited to try it, but it seems like it'd work.
Yeah, the amaretto might be like a little sweet for my blood, but I'm into what you're doing there.
The raspberries really take down the sweetness on the amaretto.
Mm-hmm. Nice. Oh, I love it.
That's interesting.
Yeah, I guess actually like went light on the lemon because the acidity of the raspberries was already there.
All right.
Nice. I'm also drinking a cocktail today instead of wine because I drank wine last night and I don't feel like drinking wine two nights in a row. Fancy that. So this is a play on a Chicago Fizz. A Chicago Fizz is a classic pre-prohibition era cocktail, the origins of which have been lost to the ether. The traditional recipe is equal portions of rum and ruby port with fresh lemon juice, a little tiny bit of sugar, and an egg white. You shake the ever-living shit out of it to get that nice foam, and then you pour it into a glass with some soda water. I handmade mine a little bit, though. So the rum that I'm using in this is Privateer. Privateer rum. Remember, I've talked about this before. Anyone that's a veteran of our podcast knows that I'm a huge fan of Privateer rum. They are based in Ipswich, Massachusetts. Their head distiller, Maggie Campbell, is a fucking badass. But I figured it would be nice to use a rum that was based out of the Boston area, where Janine so desperately wanted to go back to. Instead of using a ruby port, because there's no affiliation to ruby port here, I used Inniskillen ice wine. I use a little splash of Inniskillen Cab Franc ice wine. So it's a dessert wine that's made in Niagara Escarpment in Canada, where the girls are trying to get to. So they're stuck between these two worlds. Also, it's fucking delicious. Instead of using lemon juice, because I ran out of lemons, I went with a blood orange. So the juice of a blood orange, which you can see propped up right there. I'm a big fan of using blood orange in my cocktails. I think it adds a nice sweetness to it. It gets that nice rich red color as well, which we love of our Handmaid's tie-ins. Yeah, and then a little bit of egg white. And I have my Chicago Fizz, Handmaid's style. I didn't think of a clever name for it, though. I'm terrible with names. So cheers.
That's a really great looking drink.
Honestly. It's gorgeous. It is so gorgeous.
Just like you two. Cheers.
All right, Rox, I'm going to put you to a task. What would I use to replace the egg and still get that foam?
Ooh.
That's the thing I've been thinking about because I don't really think any of the egg replacers I normally use would really quite do the trick. I know there's an egg replacer you can use for meringue, so I'm wondering if that would be the one I need to use.
So what you're thinking for the egg replacement for meringue, if you've ever made canned chickpeas.
So is it the aquafaba water?
Yes, aquafaba. So if you take canned chickpeas and you strain off the liquid that's in there, that's called aquafaba. Aquafaba can foam up really nicely the same exact way as a meringue. And you would think that being with chickpeas, it's going to have like that sort of like earthy flavor to it. Honestly, just like a little dash of sugar in there and it's totally gone.
Okay, so you can absolutely
use that.
Yeah, because that has that, from what I know, adding egg, aside from the froth, it also can change the mouthfeel of the drink. And that is definitely what aquafaba is that what it is?
Aquafaba, yeah.
That has that like silky, it's almost too much sometimes. Sometimes I don't rinse my chickpeas well enough from the can. And it's just like, it's very silky and thick, but sometimes it's not really quite the texture you want, depending what you're doing. So soups is my issue. Specifically, my kid hates it when I don't rinse them well enough. But you're right. That texture in a cocktail would be fantastic. Mm-hmm. And if you can mask the flavor, oh, that's so cool. Thank you. Yeah. I knew you'd have an answer for me.
Absolutely. Yeah, it gives it that creaminess. That gives it that soft, silky texture. It'll definitely get you that like nice, aggressive foam like this has as well. And makes it totally vegan. Hooray!
That's cool.
Yeah. So there we are.
Right on. So my initial thoughts on this, I don't know, guys. It looks like we got it. We got our bridge plot line to the Testaments.
Yes. Yeah. Yep. 100%, right?
I can't even believe that we can say that now.
Yeah.
We speculated this since mm-hmm. September of 2019, mm-hmm. since we got our hands on that book, how they were going to make these two worlds meet. And here it is.
Here it is. Yeah, mm-hmm. absolutely. I think by the end of it, Lydia is well on her way to Lydia of the Testaments.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't have any major thoughts to get into off the rip because I have a tendency to get into a lot of specifics in the scene. So I'm ready to mm-hmm. jump in when you are. I don't have any other big thoughts.
Yeah, I'm very much in the same boat as you two. For me, like my big overarching umbrella of this episode was that it felt very much like a transitional episode, which we usually get yes. At our halfway point. And June goes through a transition. Janine is going through a transition. Larry, Aunt Lydia, our four major players, even Nick as well. We definitely see shifts in allegiances and shifts in alliances, shifts in mentality. And it just felt like it setting us up to hit the ground running for the back half of the season.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I did get the feeling that this was a strategic episode. This was like the placement of people. So mm-hmm. we can continue.
Yeah.
I was thinking chess at some point, and then when we had the scene with Arjua Hall and they're actually playing mm-hmm. chess, I was like, oh God, look at this. Man, I'm just channeling the show right now. Okay,
oh, I get it. I didn't even put it together that they were playing chess. I must have missed that because as you say that, that makes me think of Lydia because that's how, remember I used to say she plays the long game, she plays chess, not checkers, and you thought I was saying chestnut checkers?
Yes! Chestnut checkers!
Oh, I forgot about that. That's funny.
That is funny.
Chess, not checkers.
Right.
That is Lydia's game.
The epiphany we had when we realized that was two words and not one.
Did you both think I was saying it that way?
Yes.
That's yeah. so funny. I was funny.
Like, what the fuck is a chestnut checker? Shall we get into it?
Yeah.
All right.
So we start off with the amazing and tedious piano music from the first time that June and Luke hook up. And I knew what was happening before the screen went to the actual scene. I will never forget that music. I feel like it's the perfect sex music. The perfect sex music when you're first with somebody and you're figuring mm-hmm. them out.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I could see that. I was not as quick as you. I definitely didn't even put that connection together. Certainly not before yep. Luke's face popped up. Oh, you're good. Mm-hmm.
The breathing was what did it for me. Not so much the music, but like that, like it was a very like expectant sort of breathing is yeah. the best way to put it. My first thought was, this is Janine, like, actually, like, getting raped. Crazy Steven's taking it to another level. And then, like, the gentle music started to kick in, and I was like, oh, I was like, this is nice. This is pleasant. Where are we going with this? I don't understand. So definitely didn't pick up on it the way that you did, Scarlett.
Yeah. Well, I mean, in reality, it's just June listening to Janine and Slimy Steven
yeah.
fucking Slimy amongst Steven. The sound of gunfire and bombs. That's what's happening.
Yeah. Right.
I feel like it's been a while since we've seen her have a flashback like this, too.
Yeah.
So I thought that was interesting placement.
Right.
Yeah. You know, in regards to the gunfire and bombs, June seems to be the only person that's really concerned here.
Yeah.
And I understand their concern about her leaving to go check things out, but also shouldn't someone scope out what's going wrong? I mean, we can't right? just continue to, you know, fuck in the corner. Like, bombs are dropping. Let's find out mm-hmm. what we need to do here. It seems right. pertinent, right?
Right.
Bombs are dropping and windows are being shot out.
Yeah.
Like, it is abundantly clear that we are within a war zone. And it's both simultaneously, like, I've got a lot of feelings about the, like, this first 30 seconds. Like, I love that, like, June's flashback to, like, her first tryst in the hotel with Luke is interlaced with this woman where, there's this harsh cut where she's just staring up. Like, there's no soft transition like we usually get with Ari, like we have seen in the past. And then we hear these, like, the sex noises continuing. We know it's Janine and Slimy Steven. Mm-hmm. My first thought was, okay, great. It is Janine getting raped. This is great. But no, she seems to be like kind of somewhat enjoying it. So great. Now we have, you don't like Stockholm syndrome. right? Like you have a predilection against Stockholm syndrome, if memory serves.
No, it's just that it's not actually in the diagnostic manual mm-hmm. for psychological right. conditions. So it's not a real diagnosis. It's more of a concept that came from that robbery scenario that happened in yeah. Stockholm. And they were mm-hmm. calling the people who were feeling like they had a connection with the people who were holding them hostage by insinuating that they somehow were – there was something wrong with them, psychologically wrong with them for looking at their captors as actual people and developing mm-hmm. a kinship with them. That's what they did to survive. But also some of the people coming out of the situation were just like – they felt like they were being – looked upon as though they were crazy or there was something wrong with them simply because they had a different perspective than others in this situation.
Yeah.
It's way deeper than that and way more complicated than that.
And they believe, because you alerted me to the podcast about this. And so,
yeah, LA Not So Confidential did yes, a really, really you. Great yeah. episode on this.
And it's been a while since I revisited it, but I believe that they were saying it's also something that I don't know if it was in that specific Stockholm case or just in general moving forward thing. It's definitely something they apply to women. Like, you obviously aren't in your right mind and couldn't possibly be thinking your own thoughts. Therefore, yeah. you must have been brainwashed and coerced in some way that yeah, your little woman brain just couldn't handle.
Yeah. yeah, absolutely. So thank you for going down that. Now, for the sake of being succinct, I am still going to refer to it as Stockholm syndrome because it's...
Well, yeah, it still works as a concept. Yeah. When you're yeah. applying it to this. I don't know what yeah. else the real term would be for this interpersonal like play in an abusive relationship, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
But in this specific example, we understand that Stockholm syndrome is not part of the, was it DSM? DSM.
And I think we're on 7 now?
Yeah.
No, we 5. Understand. Sorry. I think it's DSM 5. Doesn't matter.
And it's not an actual like medical diagnosis. However, for the sake of brevity, I'm going yeah. to refer to it as such.
Yes.
So it was one of those like, is Janine actually enjoying this? Is this symptomatic of some sort of Stockholm syndrome coping mechanism? So like that was like immediately I was like, this is much more complex. And then like June looks over at this other person who is actively awake. And was he reading a book or was he like flipping through something? I don't know what he was doing, but he like looks at her and like smiles. I know that she took it at like she smiled back politely just to be like, yep, this is awkward. Great. I took it that smile that he had as like a, hey, we're hanging out, like almost laughing about the situation of like, hey, we're hanging out in this like in this community room. They're fucking. There's bombs outside. We're both awake. What is our life? I sort of appreciated that brief moment of levity. But then at the end of the day, like, no one's paying attention. There's car alarms going off. There's windows being shot out. And no one seems panicked. Does that ring to you, too, as similar to in Gilead? Like how Aunt Lydia had said multiple times that you'll get used to your circumstances. Like it might be jarring to you now, but eventually you'll get used to the way that things are. That everyone here seems to just be used to this. Even Janine is not affected by it. It seems very bizarre.
Yeah, I think, I don't know, I just think that June is the type of person that simply can't rest. It seems like a lot of the people around her, even going back to the farmhouse, they seem to just have an easier time of compartmentalizing and being like, okay, for right now, we don't have to be on high alert. Obviously, I feel like this is a situation where they should be on high alert. I mean, I would be. Bombs are dropping. But... you know, that they don't have to be on high alert all the time. And June just doesn't seem like she's that type of person that can do that. Like, I think she feels like she has the weight of the actual world on her shoulders.
Mm-hmm.
I think I do get it, too, because I do feel like that in my own life circumstances. And I actually have to remind myself to calm the fuck down. You don't have to be go, 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 high alert, high anxiety all the time. Way easier said than done. But I think that's just where June is at, like, personality-wise. Like, this is how she is now. She can't put her head down because she has way too much to be concerned about. And if people around her aren't as concerned as she is, she doesn't understand why.
Yeah, it's because she has, at this point, accepted this leadership role and lives and operates in it and as a second nature, and mm-hmm. she can't relinquish it. That's mm-hmm. what her issue is here. She doesn't, Janine has no problem because Janine is used to being the follower. She is used to being told, this is what you're going to do. We'll keep you safe. Just go over here. And mm-hmm. she's okay within that position, at least so far that we've seen. And mm-hmm. June was forced into a leadership role. She was forced to then have to make sure that her people were going to be safe. She doesn't have a great track record right now, and that's already weighing on her. And she just can't trust Steven. She can't. She can't trust any leader, any person who, especially one that doesn't want to give her the time of day and let her know mm-hmm. what they're thinking and bring her to the table and give her a seat at the table, which is a thing that comes up a lot. And it's definitely the running thread through this episode is this lack of this leadership being taken away, this power, this control being taken away from people that are used to operating and benefiting. And, you know, it's different for each person. But with June here, I think that's why she can't rest, because she doesn't trust that Steven or anyone else is going to say that it's okay until June sees for herself that it's okay. She needs a plan. She wants to make the choices. She wants Janine to just come with her and not question anything about her choices. But she can't give that blind faith to Steven the same way that Janine has given it to June mm-hmm. or to Steven.
Yeah.
Right. Something that to that leadership role. I mean, it's abundantly clear that Steven is the de facto leader of this weird fringe rebel group. When Steven yelled, "It's not safe, get back in bed," that rang less to me and obviously I'm like not keen on this guy already, but mm-hmm. that rang less to me of someone who is a true leader saying, "Hey, it's not safe right now. Hunker down. We'll figure it out." And more of like a controlling relationship sort of vibe. Like it felt like it felt less of a leader sentiment and more of a manipulative sentiment. Does that make sense?
I think so. I just didn't read it that way. Mm-hmm. But I think I see where you're coming from. I just feel like he's more – I feel like he looks at June the same way that June would look at someone else who just showed up and now she has to care for and be responsible for. Mm-hmm. Of like – it's kind of the way she treated Esther a little bit. Like we had talked about that of like June is the leader. She's trying to make these choices. She has so many things on her plate and sometimes she just can't give the time of day to all these people that just need to do what she knows is the right thing to do. I feel like that's what Steven feels like in this situation. We're going to see later in this episode, he does want to keep his people safe and alive, and he thinks that June is reckless because she is. He's already picking up on the type of leader that June is, and it's just different than him. He has a different motivation, a different goal, a different style. So all of those things are going to play in, and I just don't think it's something that June wants mm-hmm. to stick around for, which is why she leaves.
That makes sense. I appreciate that shift in perspective, because the way that I read that was like the whole get back in bed rang to me of like of an abuser. And it might have just been because like he and Janine were just having sex. And we know that the start of this relationship was that she was in a forced position and had no other recourse. And she allowed herself to steal herself because she's been in that situation before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it just felt so unsavory when he said it.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
Thank you for that little shift.
Yeah. I think that that specific line, I think within the context of what I was saying, that was him being exasperated with her for getting out, especially while he's in the middle of something. Like, he doesn't really need to be dealing with June wandering around right now while bombs are going off. Like, hey, dummy, lay in bed. Everything's fine. I'm trying to get laid. I also don't think that he is the same kind of abuser that you're seeing him as based on that scene with Janine. I think he's more of a opportunistic abuser. Yeah. Like, that was just him being like, well, this is my power and you have nothing, so this is a way for me to find a use for you. Mm-hmm. And that's why he didn't like June, and he told June she could leave because he didn't want to feel like he was forcing her. That was that comment. And so I don't think he is an abuser of his power as much in the grand scheme of things as he is within what these women who showed up with nothing could do for him in that moment. That makes sense?
That makes sense, yeah.
Absolutely. Like, I don't think he's a predator. I don't think he seeks out women in which he can take under his wing to therefore use in his ways. I think he is mostly just annoyed that June showed up and is annoying.
I think too, I feel like we get this in the next scene when June starts asking questions about how does one go about trading here. Mm-hmm. I get the feeling that by this point, June is just all set with men.
Yeah.
You know, she doesn't want to deal with this dude that's like looking at her like, hey, what's up? You know, when the bombs are dropping and they're all like laying down. She just can't be bothered. She does not like slimy Steven. Completely mm-hmm. understandable. I don't like slimy Steven either. Nope. Then to find out when she's questioning Teresa in the next scene that if she wants to go participate in this trading process, which first of all, it's echoes of season 3 when she was trying to get in on the Martha network mm-hmm. and the other Marthas were just like, no, thank you. She's just disgusted. Like even here, she has to check in with a guy to get permission to do something. And she's over it. Like she's over having to take cues from the menfolk.
Yeah.
We'll say this though, as much as I hate slimy Steven, and as much as I don't like his sentiment of the way that he said, it's not safe, get back in bed, because it's not safe there either. There is glass that's being shattered. It's not safe anywhere. June, when she like was going up the stairs and then approached that window and then put the lantern in the window. Maybe slimy Steven was onto something, because June, it's not safe to be walking around and putting a lantern in the window of the dilapidated mill turned outpost. What are you doing? You're a logistical, tactical nightmare right now.
No, she really was. That was actually driving me crazy. And that's something that we see like through the rest of the episode is how she doesn't necessarily know what she's doing outside of her little sphere that she was operating with before. And she definitely comes off as a liability.
Mm-hmm. Her instincts are strong, but her lack of forethought, even like within a minute, is exactly like you said, makes her a liability. Like, girl, just get your light out of the window. I understand wanting to watch that gunfire. And wanting to watch that military exchange, because that's fascinating. And that's the sort of thing that we are, as Americans, we are very fortunate in that we are used to only seeing that on our TV screens.
That's funny that you mentioned that.
That's exactly what I was thinking, though, because that's what it felt like to me, because they've been talking. This isn't like news to any of us watching this show that there's a war happening in Chicago. And Janine has said it many times in the last episode, like, wait, why are we going to the front of a war? And there is something different about hearing it and thinking about it versus actually seeing where they are. And it was very jarring.
Yeah. And especially like watching the mortar, like it's night and you see those shining like lights of mortar flying from both directions. It rang so similarly to we're of a certain age. Do you two remember like in like the early 2000s in Iraq, like watching these night bombings happening that the United States perpetrated?
I remember those.
And watching those green like rocket launch lights. That's so much what it looked like.
I'm even more of an age than you are, because the reason why this reminded me of something that I would see on TV is because in sixth grade, when we went to war with Iraq and the Gulf War, I remember sitting on the floor of my parents' bedroom in their little like 12-inch TV watching the imagery of like, you know, whatever they were, these green missiles and bombs and whatever just flying across the sky.
I remember
That's what I thought of when I saw those in the distance as she was looking outside. It took me right back to that experience. And that was the first time I think a lot of us had seen anything like that. Mm-hmm. There was something very significant about witnessing that on TV.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. For sure.
Remember that distinctly. And having June get to see that and witness that in person when, as an American, even though that's understood, like exactly like you said, Marjorie, we've had years of mental preparation for this. We know that Chicago is a war scene. We know that this is a contested front. But to have her actually see it, and for us to actually see it and experience it, makes it real. But also, God damn it, get the light out of the window, June.
Please?
Please. I feel like even as people that have no experience in war zones, we would at least have the wherewithal to move the light from the window while you're observing this as a protective measure.
I don't need to be in a war zone. I grew up in an apartment building. If there's a light on inside, they can see you if you can see out.
Like, yeah, that's a great
and we
point.
Were... Nosy little kids who like to look out the windows. I actually yelled at my kid the other day because there was a cop up front of our house and the lights were on in our bedroom, in my bedroom, and she was using my room to look out, and she just like, it's the middle of the night, and she like flung open the blinds and was like, what's happening out there? And I was like, do you know they can see you like clear as day right now? Like, you look like an idiot. Like, and she was like, what do you mean they could see me? Like, and she kind of understood, but like, she just never had like the... I need to look at the neighbors while they don't see me feeling. Like, she just, yeah. It's not a thing she's had to do. Whereas I just feel like that is how I grew up. Like, you were always looking out windows trying to see what was happening without anyone seeing in.
Yes. You can be a nosy neighbor without being like, without bringing attention to yourself.
Can someone tell the old ladies on my street that? Because every time something happens, they literally come out in droves and will walk down the street to watch, and then they consult with each other at the end of each other's driveways before they decide to disperse. It's the funniest thing.
It's so funny, huh?
I live on a street full of retirees. This is really how it is.
That's the excitement of the week for them.
Fuck yeah.
I'd love for that to be the excitement of the week for me. Something exciting happening on the street. Not a war zone.
It's a big day.
But just to clarify. So anyway, then we cut to June washing her handmaid's robe.
That was interesting, huh?
Yeah. Why? Obviously, we find out later that she's washing it to, like washing it was a good idea because then it almost certainly brought a higher value for trade. But why was she washing this? Why was she tending to this just so?
I think it's because she's starting to pick up on the fact that everything that comes into their possession could potentially be valuable.
Value.
Like, they're coming out of a place where in Gilead proper, their most basic needs were always provided for. And now they're in a place where they're having to employ a type of survival that they've never had to do before. Mm-hmm. There's a lack of food. There's a lack of clothing. There's a lack of all sorts of things. Mm-hmm. And so I think that she just figured, well, you know, I don't like this thing, but I probably shouldn't get rid of it. I mean, she could use it for a blanket. She could use it as a pillow. And then we see what she ends up doing with it later.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering, like, why she still had it, too. But then I just thought this is the most practical reason for her to keep it.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. It's the way in which they were showing her wash it and care for it, I just took that as her realizing that this is the only possession she has right now.
Yeah. Oh, the irony of that.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Ew.
I know.
Yeah.
She took it off of her, and now she's got to take care of it still and lug it around with her until she can find a use for it. It's ridiculous.
Well, that thing was saturated in milk. That needed to be washed.
It did need to be washed. That's a real good point. There is no value in
scraping the yogurt off of it.
Oh, my word.
It's so terrible. You're right. That's probably the biggest reason she was washing it.
Yeah.
I forgot about that.
Abomination of a smell. Good God.
Stephen came up to her and was like, you can't fucking stay here with that cloak. You got to take care of that. You either take care of the cloak or you leave.
Wash it or burn it, but it's got to go.
Yeah.
But there's also the presumption that they've been there for more than a night.
Yeah, I mean,
here's my logical thought on that is because later in the episode, we have Janine and June talking about Janine's relationship with Stephen, and Janine saying it's consensual. It was my choice for us to start having sex, and like I really like him, and having like a little bit of time to kind of like I would imagine Janine can sometimes be reckless. But I don't think she's going to fall in love head over heels with someone the first night after giving him a blowjob.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
So for her to, I had to double down on all of that and to say that it was her choice, it's consensual, I really like him, implies that there has been some passage of time. Now, it could be a week, it could be a month. We have no way of actually gauging that. But I'm going to just go out on a limb and say if she hasn't washed the milk off of that handmaid's garb by then.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. There's definitely been some time passed, so you're right.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's just her – I think it leans more towards her tending to it because it's the one actual possession that she has that no one else can lay sovereignty to. So it's her just sort of tending to that last little, like, the one thing that she has that she can barter with, physically anyway.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I really like that she was doing that in a greenhouse of sorts. And after I was already thinking, like, wow, she's washing her only possession. She's trying to care for her only possession. It made me think that this greenhouse is so different than Serena's greenhouse, which was just obviously she was using it for flowers. So it just jumped out at me that this is a greenhouse. And I was like, oh gosh, and Gilead is elsewhere. And then I was like, no, they need this. They are growing food and being resourceful. And this is the most useful greenhouse I have seen so far.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Those are some nice looking collards.
Yeah. Well, then June approaches Terry, who is sorting through rations, the rations that they acquired from the train. So perhaps there wasn't a huge amount of time, but like for me, like there seems almost an implication of like about a week, maybe.
I think a week sounds good.
I think okay. A week, yeah. I don't think it was much more than that, but I do think that there's still like, you know, taking stock in what they have and getting it ready to be brought off to the museum and traded or whatever they're going to do with it. So, yeah, I think that it didn't jump out at me as like too weird that they were still sorting through train stuff. But I do agree that there's enough of a time where Janine has at least a rapport with Steven and June sees that this issue didn't just bubble up overnight.
Yeah. Agreed. Terry then talks with June about how they're not going to be keeping these rations. So she has no concept as to how long they're going to last. I mean, even though it does depend on the size of the camp, but they're going to be trading them for batteries, fuel, whatever they can get, as long as it's something, because what a pain in the ass it must be to lug all those across town. June really wants to be useful at this point. So she's like, let me come. I can help. And Terry's response of, that's Steven's call. Did you two notice like a twinge of like almost sadness and spite from Terry with that?
I took it more of a don't you dare think you can come in here and jump the pecking order. Okay. I already been told where my place is and yours is behind me. That's just how I read it.
That's a fair point.
Yeah, I didn't really get much of anything from her.
Mm-hmm. I mean, she's certainly not, she's not the most effusive, but just the way that she said it was, to me, it read as like she needed to be subtle, but the sort of tongue click that happened, that's Steven's call.
Yeah.
And the facial expression that she made, it read to me more of just like I can't do anything about this. And like, the only one that can is your boy over there who we both know isn't going to let this happen. I don't think – for me, it didn't read so much as like this is a massive controlling man. But it was more just like he runs the show here. I can't say fuck all.
Yeah, I can see that. Or like it also plays into there being some kind of time passage, at least a little bit, because she could very well just be like, yeah, you're going to have to go talk to that guy. And the two of you don't really seem to be hitting it off too well. Like it could just have been that kind of responsive look of, you got to talk to Steven. Don't talk to me. I'm not the one you're trying to make friends with here.
Absolutely. And it's abundant. I mean, June's not trying to make friends with anyone here, but just like,
well, she ought to if she wants to be part of it. That's, I think, what Janine's whole point is later. You need to make some friends, damn it.
Yeah, like play along a little bit.
You need friends to survive. That's my biggest point out of this episode, is that you need alliances. You need someone with you. And I feel like at this point, I get June's whole exhaustion of, I'm sick of trying to make friends. I'm sick of trying to find safety. I'm sick of everywhere I go, I have to play these mental games to figure out what people want so I can figure out how to exist within their motivations. Like, that's exhausting. And I get that.
Absolutely. I think it's – I think – Janine makes a good point or later in the episode, and this is the first time that we get to actually see that June needs to, or the second time we get to see it. June needs to be better at just making friends and being nice, but like I think at this point she's seen too much shit to really be able to do that. She's gone through so much trauma.
that's where I think the issue is that she hasn't had the time to process in the way that Janine has. So Janine is going to be at a different place within this little like faction rebel camp place that they found. June is physically exhausted. She is mentally exhausted. And she has a little bit of reprieve with this place, but she's not conditioned to know how to rest and find strength in that reprieve. She needs to keep going, much in the way that Lydia does.
Yep. Absolutely.
So the next scene, Slimy Steve is showing Janine how to shoot. Ugh. Dry firing is still dangerous, folks. And June walks in and serenades their flirtatious moments by saying that she wants in on the trading expedition. What he says when she asks this really didn't score any points with her. Fresh meat stays here. Now she's got this guy who she already doesn't really like. And now he is saying that she is meat. And I know that he didn't mean it like that, but I think June is just like, I've been meat for an awfully long time. Mm-hmm. And she just really bucks at the idea that she has to follow him around like a little duckling. Like she can't do anything without his say-so. Right. But Janine does go to bat for her.
She does.
And it was really, really perfect. And June looked very pleased and grateful when Janine was saying those things. Yeah. She couldn't stifle her smile. She couldn't not look at Janine with some appreciation for saying that.
Yeah. Well, I think that she's really, my biggest takeaway from what June is feeling with Steven is more of the fact of how Steven is seen by Janine. I think that's the biggest issue that June has with Steven overall is the relationship that Janine has with him, because I think she feels like she's losing Janine. She feels like, I am the person who has gotten you this far. We've just had this blowout in the milk refrigerator. A lot of shit has gone down. We still have things we need to deal with. And now you've got Steven in your life. You're sleeping with him at night. Like, I feel like she feels like she's losing her sidekick. She's losing her person. And it was more like jealousy, I guess, is at least in this scene, how I feel like she saw Steven. And not even so much as a leader, the leadership role that he has, as much as the role that he has in Janine's life.
So do you think June is a little jealous of this scenario?
Yeah. I think that she wishes that Janine was looking to her the same way she's looking to Steven now. And I feel like that's why she was so happy that Janine threw her that bone of, hey, you know, she really did a lot for me. She saved me. And that was all the things that June had just screamed at her in the refrigerator. And so for Janine to kind of pick up on what June seems to be feeling, at least in my mind, and throw her that bone of be like, no, she's really a good leader. You should trust her. She got me this far.
I wouldn't be here if it weren't for her.
Yeah. I can't get away from the fact that I see June as the older sister to Janine. To me, especially when you guys were talking about how, she just needs to make a friend. My sister, when she came into high school with me, one of the first critiques she gave me was, I need to smile more in the hallway. People think I'm mean. And I was so pissed off because it's such an annoying little sister thing to say. I'm like, I don't need more. And I remember yelling at her, I don't need more friends. I'm fine. Don't you dare tell me I need to smile more. Like, God, it's just such an obnoxious sister thing to say. Everything about this episode, their interactions just rung so true to what I've actually experienced in my life with my sisters. It's just all of that feeling of someone that you are so, so close with, someone that you trust, someone that you've had to kind of get through this life together so far. I feel like Aunt Lydia is their twisted and terrible mother. And they both have had this like traumatic life with this woman. They're now all each other has as they try to make it through the world. And you got Janine being like, you know what? I think I like this better. That's threatening to June. Might not be fair, but I can see why she would feel that.
The only thing, other thing I have to say is once Janine vouches for June, it does soften Steven a little bit. And he is still very much like understanding that June is reckless, dangerous. She could endanger the entirety of the camp, but also like the whole, you do what I say. Ugh, I hate this guy. I hate him aggressively.
Yeah, I think what you're feeling is exactly what June feels of, I've had enough of you men telling me what to do, and I don't need it from you, Steven.
Exactly.
Get over yourself, buddy. So then June walks away with a smile, There's old-timey music, which cuts to Ardua fucking Hall, people. Also known as the aunt's playground, where they live and learn how to do aunt things like shaming women, forcing them to submit themselves to regularly scheduled rape, beating them, and cutting off their body parts. And also, Aunt Lydia on a treadmill strikes me as so funny, just like when she was zooming around on the electric scooter in the beginning of season 3 and Alma called her Hell on Wheels. Can't wrap my brain around Aunt Lydia on a treadmill. It's hilarious to me.
I know. I agree. In that uniform, I'm like, that cannot be easy to work out in.
Right?
Like, so, it looks so restrictive.
For me, like, as I was watching this, I was so taken aback by the notion of, like, everything else that was happening around. So you have tea and biscuits, which right there is something normal. You have music playing, which I haven't been able to find what song this is. Once we can see the closed captioning, I'll tell everyone. I'm sure it's really wonderful lyrics, because the only lyrics I could really discern were, "Since you've been gone, I can't go on, no use in trying." And then it sort of faded into obscurity. And because the internet is a fickle mistress, the only thing I could come up with was Kelly Clarkson, "Since You've Been Gone." Definitely not that. Anyway, so you have the tea and the biscuits. You have the knitting happen. You have women existing in their own space, doing what they want with their time. You have chess. You have an intellectual game being played. You have a puzzle, which, granted, a puzzle doesn't require – it still requires some mental stimulation, but it's not quite the same. But then the picture is, oh, my God, is that the Holy Mary Mother? Like, what is happening with this picture? The music, the card games. Like, I have expected one of these aunts to pull out a cigarette.
Yeah, I was pretty surprised that they were serving tea and not alcohol. That's the vibe I got from this room.
I was half expecting milk.
Yeah, that would have been valid. That would have made me happy. But that's only at the Schlafly Cafe. We haven't got there yet.
That is true.
Not for a while.
Lids on the treadmill, like, it seemed out of place because it's this relatively modern piece of workout equipment in this otherwise archaic setting. But it was perfect because you have this wonderful balance here of this archaic setting with these women who are very clearly under a patriarchal, like, regime. However, they're also enjoying themselves, keeping themselves mentally entertained and engaged with one another without a pretense of the male gaze. It's the ultimate irony of Ardua Hall.
Yeah, it's pretty awesome. In case anybody was wondering, Ardua Hall figures very prominently in the Testaments. This, like I said, this is the aunt's playground. This is where they live. This is where they learn how to do aunt things. There are also libraries, big-ass libraries, because these aunts are allowed to read and to write. This is where they have the genealogies, and it's a very, very important place in the Testaments book.
And it is the place that they will eventually start the aunt school, the supplicant school, and that's where the girls will learn to read, the ones that are in the aunt school, since they will not have been taught to read prior to the being placed as an aunt. But there is so much interesting Ardua Hall lore in the Testaments. And I will stop telling you about it at this point, because that is a podcast for another time. In fact, we did that already.
Yes, we sure did.
That's a podcast for September through December 2019. Yep. You should check it out.
Coming to our website shortly, eventually.
Eventually.
Well, Aunt Lydia is wistfully looking outside as she's treadmilling at all of this handmade stuff going on that she's not participating in. And we come to find out that the reason that she's not participating is because she's recuperating from all of her injuries and trauma that she's had, but also because they're just putting her out to pasture now. And we know that because Aunt Ruth comes rolling up and breaks that news to her. Aunt Lydia is not accepting of this. She, as far as she's concerned, her work is not done. And she doesn't want to be put out to pasture. She doesn't want to be playing cards and doing puzzles all day with the older aunts. She wants to be out there breaking balls.
I loved watching this balance between Aunt Lydia and Aunt Ruth, because Ruth is a formidable human. I say this as someone who is 6'1", larger than most. I'm scared of Ruth. Ruth had such a physically foreboding presence that made her very intimidating. we very rarely see Aunt Lydia look small. And in this shot, she looked so diminutive. I loved watching that. I loved watching her try to claw her way back into a position of power against effectively a mountain of a woman.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I love that as she's facing that mountain, I feel like she was testing Ruth when she asked her to go speak to the commanders. Did you read it the same way?
Yeah, absolutely.
And that she failed that test and Lydia officially has a new enemy for life, because we know from the testaments that Lydia really holds a grudge. And I feel like that was her one opportunity to see. She was trying to see if Ruth was going to show her where her allegiance lies. And she did. And unfortunately, that was not with Lydia, because I think she underestimated this retired aunt at this point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And Ruth makes no bones about that either. Like, the girls are not your concern anymore. Which, what a dismissive thing to say to someone who is effectively the matriarch of Gilead. Regardless of how you feel about Gilead, seeing it from the outside, if you are part of the machine, show a little bit of respect.
Mm-hmm.
And Lydia's retort of just, the girls have always been my concern. I have served Gilead with everything I have. That sentence to me is very interesting, because I have served Gilead with everything I have is both past tense and present tense. It's like, a tense is weird on that. And then Ruth sort of corrects her, because Ruth says to Lydia, I admired your devotion, with a D. Mm-hmm. So it was very much past tense, while you were still active, just doubling down on the fact that Lydia no longer has say here. She no longer has pull. There's a new sheriff in town. And I found that extremely compelling that anyone would speak to Aunt Lydia in that fashion, because this is our first view inside Ardua Hall. For us as the viewer, Lydia has always been this omnipotent, omniscient force. But if another aunt is willing to speak to her so flagrantly in front of other aunts, perhaps Aunt Lydia hasn't had the position of power that she's always portrayed to the viewer and to us in the testaments, which then makes her an unreliable narrator in a lot of sense as well.
Yeah.
I can see that being possible. I thought it was more of Ruth taking the opportunity to strike when the seat is open, because I know she talks a lot about in the testaments about how she has to always be on guard for anyone trying to undermine her, because there are plenty of aunts who would love to see her unseated, as essentially what she says. And I feel like that's what this was. It's not that Lydia wasn't at the top at one point, as much as she has definitely fallen from grace far. And this is Ruth's opportunity to step in and let her know.
Gotcha. I like that perspective. Thank you.
Yeah, I think that's what's happening, too. I mean, this whole thing is a blow to her ego for sure. And Aunt Lydia, she has to be viewed as a qualified fuck up after this. With everything that's happened, losing June again.
Yeah.
You know, what happened to all the other four handmaids? All of this has been happening under Aunt Lydia's watch since season 3. Actually, I would say it goes back even further to season 2, when Emily kicks the shit out of her. I'm sure that while, you know, Aunt Lydia, of course, was impaired by that, and it was terrible that it happened to her, I'm sure they think it's horrible. I'm also sure that Gilead was like, that is like one of the first strikes of you having your guard down.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Do you know what's going on? I mean, you just had this woman almost kill you. And then there's the whole, situation with her beating the crap out of Janine in front of all the commanders at the Putnam's house. Like, she just has not been presenting herself very favorably in such a long time. So I feel like this,
yeah,
all of the things that have happened, she's as up Schitt's Creek in the eyes of Gilead as much as Larry is. Like, yeah, you were great once, but...
Mm-hmm.
It's time to go, Liz.
Yeah, newer and younger is moving in, and they have ambitions. And
yeah.
The first thing that needs to happen is the top needs to go. And that's, mm-hmm. you know, right. As soon as there's an opportunity, someone else is going to step in.
Yeah.
I think that with Ruth, it would have been why I think that Lydia was testing her by asking her to go speak on her behalf is that it would have been so easy to say yes and then not follow through. Like, because I know I'm pretty sure Lydia does that in the testaments multiple times. Like, she tells people she's going to go to bat for them. And then she just plays the, well, they're commanders. You can only do so much cards to be like, see, I was on your side. I did as much as I could possibly do, but I can only do so much. And I feel like that's almost what she was waiting to see if Ruth would give her that placation and at least be smart about it. And since she didn't, it was more of an ultimate power move and an opportunity to make a dig at Lydia in the process that I think that Lydia knew exactly, at this point, knows exactly who she's dealing with. And that makes me think that Ruth needs to watch out. That Godspeed at the end was very ominous.
Mm-hmm. And repeating it twice as well.
So here's the thing. She has an opportunity to stay out of it and retire. And I have not seen anything from either this or the testaments that leads me to believe that an aunt retiring is anything horrible. It really sounds like they can just go live out their, you know, days until that's it. And so I was just wondering, like, wouldn't it be safer for her just being put out to pasture and staying out of the ickiness of the work that she was doing before? Like, does she see herself as a buffer between these women and Gilead, and that's why she's doing it? Like, what is it? Is it just she can't give up that power?
I think it's the notoriety. I think she wants the resume, the legacy. She doesn't want to just go off into retirement, never to be heard from again. She wants people to know her name. And I think she likes to hide behind the guise of these are my girls and I need someone to protect them. But the way I'm seeing Lydia in the testaments now is more of the fact that that is more of the excuse to her behavior, when really her behavior is she just wants to create a name for herself and have that power and that control and that legacy.
Mm-hmm. I like that thought too, considering like with the testaments, the very first scene that we have is the this monument to her. Yeah. And she's just like, I'm not really keen on how it looks. I mean, this is how I'm going to be memorialized. It's full of bravado and it's full of conceit.
Yeah. And then she launches into, so this is why I need to tell you my story and my words, because otherwise you're going to hear crazy things about me and it couldn't possibly be true. This is what I was really doing. It's like a after the fact, let me explain.
Yes. Absolutely.
And she did it in such a way that it's almost like no matter which way the cards fall, she had herself positioned to look good regardless. Like, she gave herself notoriety and legacy within Gilead. And then also when it toppled, wanted to be the one that takes the credit for why it went down.
She wants to have her cake and eat it too.
Yeah.
Love us, hate us, either way, let us know. We appreciate feedback from intels and incels. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, or you can just shoot us an email at redresistancepodcast@gmail.com. We'd like to give special thanks to Mr. Scarlet for making our podcast sound amazing. Without him, we'd be all fuzz and echoes. We'd also like to give a shout out to Peter Levesque of Heliovox for providing us with our badass intro and outro music. Thank you for listening, and try not to let the bastards grind you down.